Hosea 14 chapters, 197 verses, 5,175 words, if you hadn't taken notice this week as you were reading ahead. The first three chapters are kind of a prologue that set the stage and actually give us some details of the prophet's life, more personal information than we really have on the other prophets. And it sets the stage, giving us a relationship between him and his wife and children, and then uses all of that as a similitude or a parable of what God is experiencing in his personal love for the nation of Israel. Hosea is prophesying in the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, where the kings reigned in Samaria, while Isaiah and Micah are prophesying in the kingdom of Judah. They were contemporaries. As we read into the beginning of the chapter, it will give us the names of four kings in Judah, and their reigns span 120 years. Now, obviously, Hosea did not prophesy for 120 years, but it was during those reigns. Evidently, he picked up at the end of the reign of the first king and prophesied into the beginning of the last king named. Though he was in the north, it gives us the names of the kings that reigned in Judah, because it was the house of David that God had named and was honoring. And we only have the name of Jeroboam the second, who began in the beginning of Hosea's ministry. And there were six other kings in the north that were not named. It gives us the names of the reigning kings in the south. Kind of interesting. Hosea, or Hoshea, you'll find in Numbers 13, was the name of the son of Nun. You're familiar with him as Joshua, the son of Nun. And you remember when the 12 spies went into the land that Joshua and Caleb came back with a positive report and wanted to go in and take the land. Well, Joshua's name had been Hoshea, and it was Moses who tagged the prefix on it, Yah, and turn it into Yahoshia or Yehoshua, Joshua, what we have today. And the name Hoshea means salvation. And that's interesting, of course, as we look at the book. Some of the scholars that I was reading through say the book of Hosea is the second greatest story that's ever been told. Of course, the New Testament gospel is the greatest story ever told. But there is so much a reflection of the gospel and God's love and a prelude to it in the book of Hosea, that some see it as the second greatest story that has ever been told. It is, out of 16 prophetic books in the Old Testament, the only one with an epilogue. So why don't we look there? That's the very last verse. Interesting that Hosea is the only one for some reason. Chapter 14, verse 9 gives us the epilogue. It says, who is wise and he shall understand these things? Question mark. That means it's open for any of us. Who is prudent and he shall know them? For the ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them, but transgressors shall fall from them. So there is a challenge, as he sums up his prophecy, to be wise, to be prudent, to be intelligent, to be filled with knowledge, to understand the ways of the Lord, not just to understand them, but to walk in them, so that we might walk with the Lord. It was a time of prosperity. He prophesied from about 760 B.C. down to the judgment of Samaria as the Assyrians came. He saw that, and he prophesied and it's interesting because that's where our nation is. Our nation has come to a place where certainly whatever we may complain of in regards to taxes or one other thing, you know, we're Americans, we love to grumble. Still, this is the best place going. as far as I'm concerned, and we have prosperity that is unimagined in most parts of the world. We don't have slaves or butlers or servants, you might complain. I don't have a butler in my house or a maid in my kitchen, but you have ice makers and you have water on tap and you have a refrigerator keeping your food cold. You do. They're just electronic. You haven't noticed them or said thanks to them. Dishwashers and, you know, clothes washers and dryers and unimagined in most of the world. So much like the condition of Israel in the time, and we'll see many parallels as we go through, Hosea is facing that backdrop. He says, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah," these are southern kings in Judah, "Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam," this is the second, "son of Joash, king of Israel," only names the one northern king. And again, there would be six kings that would reign in the same period of time. Now, it seems he gives us this in retrospect, looking back from the end of his ministry, the beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. "And the Lord said to Hosea, go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son." Frank, would you have killed this air conditioner? It keeps blowing the pages of my Bible. Like, you guys got this aimed in the wrong place again here. God will tell Hosea to take a wife. Now, there are debates whether she was already immoral when Hosea took her to wife, that we don't really have that information. It seems to anticipate the fact that she will be unfaithful to him and ultimately sell herself as a prostitute and ultimately become a slave. And God asked Hosea to take this wife. He bears children. The pain that he feels as she is unfaithful to him, some of you may be familiar with if you have had a spouse be unfaithful to you, or perhaps if you have been engaged or been in love with someone and that person has decided to leave you or to be unfaithful to you, you may know something of that pain. And what God will do with Hosea is he will deepen his ministry and deepen the pathos of his preaching, because God will tell Hosea, this is how I feel in a sense, because Israel was my wife and I loved her and she went in whoredoms after other gods and she was unfaithful to me and in idolatry she served other gods. And then as God will send Hosea to the nation of Israel, it will be that pain and that burden that lends itself to the message that he has. Now, as I look at these things, sometimes, you know, you look at people like Johnny Erickson or Corey Ten Boom, or and you say, Lord, you know, give me, you know, Lord, that without the pain. You know, give me the depth without the deep stuff. You know, can you just let me listen to their tapes and learn from their experience and then just give me the stuff so I don't have to go through what they went through to get it? But I don't think it goes that way. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 says that the God of mercy and the Father of all comforts comforts us in our affliction, that we may comfort others ultimately with the same comfort we were comforted with. And there's a real experience in this in the life of Hosea, to where he takes Gomer, he loves her, she bears three children to him. Some question whether one was born in her unfaithfulness, we don't have the details. But he ends up with a broken heart. When one of the incredible things communicated here is the suffering of God, the pathos of God. And again, you know, it's interesting to hear unbelievers say, how can a God of love allow there to be starving children? How can a God of love allow there to be war? How can a God of love, you know, and what they're really saying to you is, God ain't a God of love. Because look at all these terrible things that go on in the world, and if he's really there, I don't want to worship him because he lets this stuff happen. And again, the amazing thing is, and C.S. Lewis said, death is total in every generation. Everybody dies, whether by war, whether by a bomb, whether by old age, whether by cancer. Death is total in every generation. The remarkable thing is he has made a way for us to live eternally. The remarkable thing is he has reached into our lives, and he has provided a way that we can have hope in a world that is filled with all of this insanity. And he is not at all like unbelievers portray him, because one of the most remarkable things in Scripture, and I think as I go on with the Lord, it's been 20-some years now, and the more it comes to the surface, the more I'm almost afraid to embrace it, because the more I see that there is this side of God where he makes himself vulnerable to us, because he wants to have this relationship with us. Again, you think of the verse that tells us not to grieve the Holy Spirit of God. And anyone who's done a study on the Holy Spirit knows that this is the same person. That God the Spirit is God. There isn't anything that God the Father is or Jesus Christ is that God the Spirit is not. And remarkably, as we think of that, to grieve means to make sorrowful or to cause pain. It's the word that is used of the sorrow that someone feels when their loved ones pass away. As it says in 1 Thessalonians 4, I would not have you sorrow, there's our word, even as those who have no hope, speaking about grieving for a lost loved one. And the remarkable thing, it tells us not to grieve the Holy Spirit of God. Now, it would almost be blasphemous for you and I to think that here is God who reigns on high, who laid out the universe with the span of his hand, and yet has placed himself in the position, because he desires to have a relationship with us, where the Scripture beckons us, do not grieve God the Spirit. Do not cause him sorrow. Do not cause him pain. And remarkably, he takes Hosea, and in Hosea's experience of an unfaithful wife, says to Hosea, this is how my heart is broken when my people turn away from me and go after other gods. Now, you have to understand, in America, because of our Western logical, scientific, cultured mind, we don't see our idolatry as idolatry. We may worship pleasure, or we may worship success, or we may worship power, and even as Christians, we may backslide into that mind frame, and it would help us greatly as Americans if we had a little statue or a little idol for pleasure, so that we knew clearly what we were doing, or that we had a little statue for power, or a little statue for success. So that when we sought those things, we remembered what God we were worshiping. Because in ancient Israel, there was an idol or a statue or a figurine for all of those different things. And God clearly called it idolatry. But here in America, we worship those things as a nation. We've turned our hearts away from God, but we don't identify them because we don't relate them to the little statues or little figurines. And God is saying to Hosea, when my people turn away from me like this, after other gods, after idolatry, this is the kind of pain that I feel. This is the kind of sorrow and suffering that I experience. Now, one of the differences is this. Hosea could only feel the pain from his wife being unfaithful within the realm of his experience. In other words, if we can have three people in the front row here whose spouses have all cheated on them, we can't take that pain and triple it and put it on one person. Each one can only feel their own pain. God is the only one who can feel the compound pain of every human heart, saved and unsaved, that is turned away from him, with 5 billion living human beings on the planet today. If you can imagine that. And God suffers when we are unfaithful to him, because it is our sorrow that is then experienced. You see, if my wife were to be unfaithful to me, I would be sorrowful because it would hurt me, because someone I loved had left me. When you and I turn away from God, or when a believer turns away from God, or when people turn away from God, he sorrows because they will suffer from turning away from him. He suffers more because of your loss than he does because of his own. He suffers because of the pain you experience and the emptiness and the vanity you experience and I experience when we turn away from him. So there's this remarkable scene, and if I made this up or I wrote this story, it would almost be blasphemous for me to tell you as the people of God that if we turn our hearts away from him, if we deliberately sin, if we live in rebellion, that you can break the heart of God. Ezekiel clearly mentions that in his prophecy, that you have broken me, God says to his people. And we see, we can't imagine him like, the unbeliever never imagines our God like that. They think, you know, is this that the big thou shalt not that lives in the sky, you know? And if you mess around, he throws a lightning bolt down and makes you dance or something. Whereas the scripture is revealing someone completely different to us. God revealing himself to us through his word actually says that there is this relationship, so, and that he might enter into it and enjoy it because his very nature is love, that he has actually made himself vulnerable. And you see, you know yourself, when you fall in love, you can only be in love to the point that you're willing to be vulnerable. And that's why it's so hard for somebody who's divorced or someone who's been injured in that kind of experience to once again make their lives vulnerable all over again, because the point of vulnerability that you extend is the point that someone can step on your heart and crush it. And it's hard for me to imagine that if I've had a busy week, you know, if I go all day without talking to my wife, or 2 days without talking to my wife, or a week without talking to my wife, she's hurt. She gets angry. It's hard for me to imagine that in my busy life, that if I don't take the time to be with the Lord, that I make him sorrowful. It's hard for me to remember when I push through all my busyness and I get back to sit with him to say, Lord, I'm so sorry. I know you love me. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And you know, doesn't it almost sound strange to say that? Because, you see, he is a God of power, and he is the Almighty King, and he will come back in power and glory. And the more I grow in realizing his glory and his majesty, on the other side of that coin, the greater necessity there is for me to grow in his grace. Because the more light I walk in, the more flaws I see in my own being. And wonderful, what a wonderful story it is then to see Hosea communicating something to us that was most clearly revealed in the New Testament. God says, take a wife of whoredoms, Hosea. For the land, Israel, hath committed great whoredoms, departing from the Lord. And in chapter 12:10, God says he's speaking now to the nation in similitudes, because they have not listened to his voice, to his word, to his prophets. So he's playing charades with them. You saw the strange things that Ezekiel did. There are strange things that Isaiah did. God now, in similitudes, is painting pictures for the nation. So take this wife of whoredoms. So he went and he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. And the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel, which is sown or scattered as the scattered seed, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. So he makes reference to the sin of the house of Jehu after Ahab and Jezebel reigned in the north, who were the most wicked in many ways. It seems that Ahab, in his later years, after Jezebel was dead, that he tried to turn his heart towards the Lord. There seemed to be somewhat of a change. And yet Jehu, still angry over the wickedness of Ahab, reproduced it in himself. And you'll find that if you're bitter or angry about the flaws of someone else, what you do if you don't let go of that is just produce it tenfold in your own life. And Jehu then asked for the sons of Ahab, and Ahab had 70 sons, more than one wife, obviously. And he asked for all of the heads of Ahab's sons to be cut off, and they were brought to him in baskets, a gruesome, gruesome thing. And Jehu also killed Ahaziah and 42 of his relatives from the south, touching the house of David. And Jezreel became a valley of blood. You know, it just became, there was a gruesome note that was attached to it because of the house of Jehu. And then God says here, he says, name your son Jezreel, because I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and I will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And that was by bringing the Assyrians to judge the northern 10 tribes. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel, the strength of Israel, as it were, in the valley of Jezreel, the valley of Armageddon, the valley of Esraldon, the same valley, certainly a foretaste of things that will take place ahead of us in the battle of Armageddon. By the way, when we say the Battle of Armageddon, you need to realize that battle actually goes from Jezreel all the way down to Edom. On the other, it's about a 200-mile range of people gathered. One of the main mustering places seems to be Armageddon, the Valley of Jezreel, but the dead go all the way down south of Jerusalem. It doesn't all take place in that one valley, but certainly here, a bloody valley from the beginning, and Hosea will prophesy into the judgment of the northern tribes and see it. And she conceived again, this is Gomer's wife, and bare a daughter. And God said unto him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah. Now Ruhamah means mercy or compassion, and the prefix Lo, L-O in front of it, means no compassion or no mercy. So call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. God speaking of that time frame as he brought the Assyrians. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, this is in the south, and I will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now, this was fulfilled, of course, in a remarkable way. After the Assyrians took Samaria and carried away the northern tribes, Sennacherib headed south and surrounded Jerusalem. And there Hezekiah, as he was encouraged by the prophet and by the people to hold out and not to try to worm his way out of the situation, told that God would intervene as they got up one morning, you remember, and looked over the wall. The camp of the Assyrians was still and full of corpses, and the angel of the Lord had come in and slaughtered 185,000 Assyrians in one night. And God said, I will deliver the southern tribes, but not by bow, not by arrow, not by their might, but by my hand. And what a remarkable thing that must have been. Gives you, you know, you can imagine what Jesus meant when he said to Peter, after Peter cut the guy's ear off, you know, he said, Peter, put your sword away. I could call down 12 legions of angels right now. That's a scary thought. If one angel killed 185,000 guys in one night, legions, 12 legions, thousands of angels could do some serious damage. Now, when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ami. Now, Ami means my people. The prefix Lo means not my people. For ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Now, and again, it's speaking of the present frame, because there is a covenant he made with Abraham that would not go broken. Interesting, Peter picks up on this and says, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, Lo-Ruhamah, but are now the people of God, Ruhamah, compassion and mercy. which had not obtained mercy, but now he says you have obtained mercy. So Peter sees in the church that now instead of lo ami and lo ruhama, that we now, though we were not a people and had not obtained mercy, now in Jesus Christ all of those things have come to us. So Peter picks up on this very analogy here remarkably. Verse 10 says this, and I love it, it begins with the word yet. Now, there's a lot of grace there, you'll see as the verse begins. Though he's not going to show mercy, and he says that they're not going to be called my people, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, you are the sons of the living God. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel, and he's going to say they're no longer going to be divided, be gathered together and appoint themselves one head. And they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. And I think that looks forward to Armageddon. Now, obviously, we saw the beginnings of that in 1948 as the children of Israel gathered back in the land. There is no longer the southern tribes and the northern tribes. There is one people, one government in Jerusalem. But it will ultimately be under one head, which will be Christ himself. And it says, they will come up out of the land. Great shall be the day of Jezreel. Now, so the first part of the message to the prophet and the lesson before, from verses four, chapters 4 to 12, we get the series of prophecies. The first thing he's teaching him is the sorrow of the Lord and the pain that God feels in regards to his people being unfaithful to him and turning away. Now, as he goes into the second chapter, he begins to speak to Hosea about the fact that he cannot condone sin or tolerate sin. And the reason is because God knows the destructive force of it. Look at Oklahoma City. You know, look at the destructive force of sin. Go to Children's Hospital or to St. Chris's and walk through and look at the destructive force of sin. And when I say that, I don't mean that the child sinned. I mean that when sin entered into the world in the Garden of Eden, there began to be a breakdown of the fabric of God's creation. And we can see it all around us in man's selfishness, in his suffering, in his vainglory, in his inability to govern himself, in his bigotry and in his hatred and the war. So God does not tolerate sin in the life of a nation or an individual because he knows the destructive consequences of it. And he would not be love. God is love. It would not be the essence of his nature if he tolerated or condoned sin, because he understands way more than we do what it means. Some of us only understand, as Hebrews 11 says, the pleasure of sin, and that for a season. But the larger picture of sin is not its pleasure. It is the havoc that has wreaked on the human race. Say ye unto your brethren, am I, and to your sisters, Ruhama, plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, Hosea now speaking, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts. Now he's feeling the pathos of God, understanding the error of sin. Lest I strip her naked and set her as in the day that she was born, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. You know, God sees the wife, Gomer, as the nation and the children as the individuals of the nation of Israel, and is using now this similitude to give Hosea the beginning of his prophetic ministry. Verse 4 says, I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. For their mother hath played the harlot, she hath conceived them, hath done shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, the idolatry, and give me that, now this is important, that give me my bread and my water and my wool and my flax and oil, my drink. They fill my belly. They take care of my physical needs. Here the idolatry is really in the material realm. Now it's interesting because remember Jesus, when he fed the 5,000, it said they would have taken him by force and made him king. Because anybody who feeds everybody is going to be king. When the Antichrist shows up on the scene, that's what he's going to be. He's going to be the guy with the answers, and you set somebody on a stage today that has the answers, everybody will put them in. As long as I can lead a hassle-free life and put food in my mouth, you can be king. And in this idolatry, Israel had come to the point where she thought that Baal and Ashtoreth and these other gods were the ones that gave her her bread and her flax and her seed and her wool and so forth, because Baal was the god that they worshipped and believed that he was in charge of the elements, the rain and the lightning and so forth. And it was through worshipping these Canaanite gods, the Canaanites believed, that the land flourished. So the Israelites had adopted that and had begun to worship material well-being rather than the living God. Verse 6 says, therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall that she shall not find her paths. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. So again, through Gomer, the whole nation is seen, much like the prodigal son. God says this, would my people and my nation turn away, and they think they're going to be satisfied with emptiness and vanity, I'm going to put a wall and a hedge of thorns about them so that they cannot enjoy the things that they think will fulfill them. And they will pursue their lovers and yet never catch up to them. And you know how that is. If you're here this evening, you don't know Christ personally, you're still in the world, you're still unsaved, you try to fill yourselves with alcohol, you know, and Saturday night or Friday night, you get drunk and you end up to be a slob or puking in a fist fight. You wake up the next morning and you're drinking, you know, tomato juice with eggs in it and honey, all kinds of, you know, stuff to try to, and then you're saying, I'll never do that again, I'll never, and you're out the next weekend doing the same old thing because you chase your lovers but you never catch up to them. You know, you chase that stuff but you never get satisfied by it. Jesus said to the woman at the well, if you'd have known who I was, you'd have asked me, and I've given you water to drink. And when you drink of the water that I give you, you'll never thirst again. The search is over when you come to Jesus Christ. And he says, I'll hedge up around them. I'm going to keep them because I love them from finding satisfaction out there, because I want them to turn back to me. And I think it's the hope of every husband or wife with a spouse that's unfaithful as they go, you know, and there's still love there, to pray, Lord, just let them see the emptiness of this. Let them see the vanity. Lord, if you can, turn them back. And we've seen it many times in the church. You know, some theologians say that God will not violate your will. And I can agree with that, but he'll obliterate all your alternatives. And I'm thankful for that. He won't violate your will, but he'll burn every bridge but one and start a fire behind you. Because he loves us. And then you'll say, I think I'll go across that bridge. You know, God says, good choice. You know, it's the only one left. I didn't violate your will, though. I'll put a hedge up with thorns. I'll make a wall that she won't find her paths. She'll follow after her lovers, but she won't overtake them. She'll seek them, but she'll not find them. Then finally, when she's worn out, it says the prodigal, when he returned to his senses, here it says, when she's worn out, she'll say, I'll go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. Boy, are we hard-headed. For she did not know, the Lord says, that I was the one who gave her the grain and the wine and the oil, and I multiplied her silver and her gold, which they prepared for Baal. Therefore will I return and take away my grain in the time thereof, and my wine in the season thereof. Speaking of the hedges and the thorns that he'll place around her. I will recover my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness, and now will I uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of my hand. God is going to remove all those things that she thought that she would be fulfilled with as she served other gods. God said she didn't realize that I was the one who gave those things to her. I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, her Sabbaths, all her solemn feasts, and I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, whereof she has said, these are my rewards that my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them up. And I will visit upon her the days of Balaam, wherein she burned incense to them, and she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and she went after her lovers and forgot or refused me, saith the Lord. Now, in verse 14, the most remarkable change comes on the scene. Hosea has learned, as he said it into this, the heartache of God. He's learned that God cannot endure sin, that God will deal, but God will deal in such a way that to drive back to himself. God's discipline is always to drive back to himself. And as they return finally, this is what they'll find. You know, sometimes I think if we backslide or we go away from God or we live in rebellion for days or months or years, we feel like when we come back, he's going to be waiting for us there with a big stick and he's going to say, I told you so. You know, now you just expect me to let you back like that, like nothing happened. You know, I'm going to make you squirm for a little while. You know, we think he's so much like us. Look what it says here. Therefore, behold, I will allure her. It means tenderly speak to her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably or unto her heart, I think the Hebrew literally is. God says he's going to woo the nation. He's going to draw them back as he does us in our emptiness when we're out there and we've turned away and we realize nothing is fulfilling us. The only reason we could say within ourselves, I'm going to return, it was better in my Father's house, is because there is something about our Father that begins to be alluring. He begins to draw us. Speak tenderly to our hearts. And I will give her her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. Achor means trouble. God says, I will give her the valley of trouble for a door of hope. You know, as the person who turns away from God travels through the valley, God makes it the valley of Achor. Three times in Joshua, come from Achan. You remember Achan's sin, and the name it became the Valley of Achor attached to him. Isaiah 65:10 says there that when God reigns on the earth, when God sets up his kingdom, he will make the Valley of Achor like Sharon. And what a beautiful plain Sharon is in Israel. You heard of the Rose of Sharon. How beautiful the plains of Sharon are along the Mediterranean Sea, one of the most beautiful places you've ever seen. And when he sets up his kingdom on the earth, he will make the valley of Achor, the valley of trouble, like Sharon. Here he says, I will use the valley of Achor to set a door of hope in front of my people. You know, that God will allow us to be troubled until we return to our right mind. It will actually be our passageway back to hope, back to look to him. The valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she shall sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. What a wonderful thing it is to come back to our first love, as when we first came out of Egypt after a period of backsliding and returned to the Lord and realize his grace. You know, I can't prescribe it. The better thing is to be obedient from the beginning. But if you're thick-headed, and I heard there was somebody in New Jersey that's thick-headed, not in Pennsylvania, but if that ever happens to you, it's such a wonderful thing when we return to the Lord. And you see, when we come back, we then are of necessity in a place to realize to a greater depth His love and His grace, because we had turned our back on it and we had walked away from Him. And there is no human form of forgiveness that measures up on the scale that will facilitate our return. But it's only the love of God, which cannot be measured on any scale, and His forgiveness and His grace that is there to meet the backslider. He said, I will heal the backslider, that I love the backslider. As we return, come out of that experience with a greater appreciation and understanding of His love and His grace for you, that you might be enriched for others who are tempted to take the same thick-headed pathway. Of course, I don't speak from experience at all. And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, husband, and shall call me no more Beli, which is master. The relationship is one of romance. When you shall return, you shall call me Ishi. For I will take away the names of Balaam, the false gods, out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. And in that day will I, and all the way through this is will I, over and over again, God initiating. In that day will I make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, with the fowls of heaven, with the creeping things of the ground, and I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth. And how I long for that day. Jesus Christ, when He sets up His throne in Jerusalem, will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth. There are 30-some wars raging right now in the world. There have been 13 years of war for every 1 year of peace in the history of mankind. Since Cain slew Abel, it has not stopped. Can you imagine what it would be like to get up tomorrow and turn on the news and have all those commentators scratching their heads because they can't find a bad story? They can't find a controversy. Turn it on. Well, you know, see Sam Donaldson. Everything seems to be okay. The weather's nice and everything's quiet and people are hugging and singing and there's no war and, you know, there's no lawyers and there's no hospitals and there's no armies and there's no bigotry and there's no abortion and there's no, you know, there's no orphans and there's no divorce and there's no, you know, they wouldn't know what to do with themselves. We won't need news because you just read it in here one time and that'll be the news from then on. That'll be great. I will break the bow, the sword, and the battle out of the earth. What a day. And will make them to lie down safely. And I will betroth thee unto me forever. God's stubborn love. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment or justice and in loving kindness and in mercies, and I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. Now, it's interesting. The word betroth there in the Hebrew means to woo a virgin. What a demonstration of God's grace. Every Orthodox and Hasidim in Israel, the Orthodox Jews, when they bind the phylactery onto their left hand, every time they do it, they repeat verses 19 and 20. I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in justice and in loving kindness and in mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. Every Jew that binds a phylactery on his left hand says those two verses as he's tying it on. Isn't it amazing? And it means to woo a virgin to yourself. Isn't that remarkable? With the condition of this nation, that God can pronounce that righteousness upon them, because in that day it will be the righteousness of Christ. Paul said to the church in Corinth that was famous for fornication, for suing one another, for getting drunk at the communion table, for their carnality, that I want to present you to Christ as a chaste virgin. Now that's got to be spiritual because it couldn't have been physical in Corinth. But the remarkable thing is that Christ can look at us all and see us in that condition because of his work and his atonement. That no matter what we've done, that as the Father looks down upon us, that he sees us in the very righteousness of Christ. How remarkable. And it shall come to pass in that day, this is a remarkable sequence. He says, I will hear, saith the Lord, I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth, and the earth shall hear the grain and the wine, the vineyards, and the oil, the olive trees, and they shall hear Jezreel. Because he's going to sow the people back in the land. Here God says there's a day coming when this sinning people, he refers to as Jezreel here, when they come back to the land and the kingdom starts, that as they go to plow the fields and to sow their seed, if you read it backwards, that the grain and the vineyard and the olive yards will hear them, and that then the earth will hear the seed, and the heavens will hear the earth and give the rain. And God says, and I will hear the heavens. And just the sequence, you know, I'll hear the heavens, and the heavens will hear the earth, and the earth will hear the seeds, and the seed will hear Israel, and the blessing will begin again. And the land is never the land unless the Jew is there back in it. Israel sown back in the land. And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, thou art my people, and we are part of this evening. And they shall say, thou art my God. We are the fulfillment of that as we are here. We're going to rush through the third chapter. You can see it, there's five verses because it goes with the prologue. Then said the Lord unto me, go yet love a woman beloved of her husband. Friend there is in the sense of husband in the Hebrew idiom. Yet she's an adulteress according to the love of the Lord towards the children of Israel. So she's an adulteress, and it's the same kind of love that the Lord has towards the children of Israel, reiterating here, who look to other gods and love flagons of wine. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver, and for a homer of barley, a homer and a half a homer of barley. So a homer and a half of barley, which was the sustenance for a slave for one day, normally animal feed, and 15 pieces of silver, which is half the price of a slave. A slave was 30 pieces of silver. God says to Hosea, you want to know how I feel? Go on out and find your wife who had given herself to whoredom. She ain't even a prostitute anymore. Now she's a slave. And I want you to purchase her for 15 pieces of silver and for a homer and a half of barley. And I'll tell you something. There was not one bit of natural affection in Hosea as he went to fulfill the word of the Lord. Hosea moved solely by obedience. And you know what happens as it goes on? He ends up loving her again. But there are a myriad of times that God asked you and I to do something, and there are no natural feelings attached to it. And God asked us to move in obedience because he knows that feelings are always subservient to obedience. And that if we obey him, though we don't feel like it, the feelings will come to life and line up after our obedience. If I wake up in the morning and feel like a Christian, I'm not sure what that means. Some people say to me, I don't feel like a Christian. I do on some days. If I wake up and the sky's blue and the birds are singing and I get a big cup of Java and the kids are still asleep and it's quiet and the air is balmy, I feel like a Christian. You know? But if I get up in the morning and I got a bad headache, and it's raining, and it's miserable, and everybody's screaming, I don't feel like a Christian. It has nothing to do with me being a Christian, by the way. I've committed my eternal destiny to Jesus, and not to Buddha, or Krishna, or somebody else. That makes me a Christian. I'm married, and you don't feel married every day if you're married, do you? Some days you feel married, some days you feel like you wish you weren't married, but you're married. It's a commitment. So if I get up in the morning and it's one of those unchristian feeling days and everything's crazy and I say to the kids, you know, by the time I get to work, because I've acted on my feelings, I feel pretty crummy about myself. I feel pretty miserable. Man, I blew it. I'm acting like a heathen again. You know. But if I get up in the morning and all that miserable stuff's going on and I have a headache and I want to grab somebody and I go, okay, Lord, you want me to do this, Lord. You want me to love, Lord. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to love, you know. And hi, everybody. Good morning, you know. And you hold it back and you control yourself and you act biblically. By the time I get to work, I'm thinking, hey, you know, I did pretty good today. I mean, you know, and you know what? The feelings have gotten in line behind obedience. And instead of feeling crummy, I feel pretty good. I feel like a Christian, you know? God says to Hosea, and to you, forgive that person. They're lower than ever. They're worth nothing. They're not even a prostitute. They're a slave. Go get them for yourself. I want you to understand my love. I want you to understand how I feel. I want you to love people the way I love people. And I want you to forgive people the way I forgive people. And I don't want you to hold bitterness. I want you to be like me. And sometimes with all of us, there is not an ounce of natural feeling that comes in line with what God asked from us. And Hosea obeyed. And he did what God asked him to do, not because he felt like it, because he understood the goodness of the Lord. And he was learning the remarkable lesson of God's love and broken heart. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver, homer of barley. Verse 3, I said unto her, thou shalt abide for me many days. Thou shalt not play the harlot. Thou shalt not be for another man. And so will I also be for thee. It seems like there's an interim. I want you to come back. And I just want you to sit here and I want you to air out your head. I want you to weigh everything out. You're not going to be a prostitute. You're not going to run to another man. You're just going to be here. And I'll be that way to you too. It seems like the feelings are not there right away. But this, let's get everything in place. Let's get it the way the Lord wants it. For the children of Israel, the Lord says to Hosea, shall abide many days, we're living in these days, without a king, without a prince, without a sacrifice, one of the problems that Judaism faces today is that the Bible clearly teaches without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. And they can say, well, we believe because the temple is destroyed, it's just in our good works or it's in faith. But clearly, from Cain and Abel, God initiated the religion of substitutionary atonement. And the Jew, because there hasn't been a sacrifice since 70 AD, really does not have anything to hang the forgiveness of sin upon. Because without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. Thank God for us, the Lamb of God was sacrificed once and for all. That Jesus died one time on the Passover. And that His blood was sufficient for every age and every generation. All sin, past, present, and future. He says, Israel. And that's the condition we see Him in the news today. No king, no prince, no sacrifice. And yet on the other side of the coin, and this is positive, with no idols, without an ephod, this is of a false prophet, for, you know, like a medium or a wizard. and without teraphim, false gods. They won't have sacrifice, they won't have a king, they won't have the things I promise, but there won't be idolatry either. And one thing that Babylon and Assyria did for Israel was cure them of idolatry. So as you look at that nation today, their king has not come, their prince is not there, they're waiting, they have no sacrifice, and there are the Kohens training today. There are serious Orthodox Jews who are training to sacrifice animals again, who believe that's necessary. A small part of the nation, but they're serious. And yet on the other side of the coin, there's no idolatry. And it says, afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. What an age it will be as the Messiah sets up his kingdom on the earth. And shall fear the Lord, stand in awe of the Lord, and his goodness in the latter days. So we move on from here, if you'll read Hosea. This gives us the setting, and it gives us the circumstances that his series of prophecies from 4 to 14 now are born out of. They are born out of Hosea's heartbreak as God allows him to experience the pain of one adulterous wife, which obviously is just a small type, because God feels all of our unfaithfulnesses, saved and unsaved, at one time. The compound unfaithfulness of man. As Jesus died on the cross, it said the sin of all the world was upon him. The sin of these people who blew up this building in Oklahoma City were upon him. The sin of Adolf Hitler was upon him. The sin of Charles Manson was upon him. The sin of every abortion, every child pervert, every murder, the sin of every evil thought, the sin of every generation of man came upon him on the cross. Hard to imagine. Hard to imagine. And his payment was sufficient for all. Though you were still 2,000 years in the future, every sin you have ever committed, you ever will commit, today and in the future, was laid upon him. And the wrath of God fell upon him on that cross 2,000 years ago, to where he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And if you're here this evening and don't know him, you're foolish to walk out of this building without knowing the one who loves you that much. Because he's not a big thou shalt not who lives in the sky, who is not concerned about your life, who has no desire to be intimate. He is one who has placed himself in a relationship with you where he is willing to be wounded by your unfaithfulness and your lack of concern with who he is. And the greater part of that wound is that he understands the damage you do to yourself, because eternity is ahead of all of us. We are eternal beings. He knows we will spend eternity with him or without him in outer darkness. And I encourage you this evening, if you don't know Christ, before you leave the building, to come up and pray with one of us. We'll give you a Bible, give you some literature to read. And for the rest of us, you know, it's just amazing as we grow in grace and the knowledge of who he is, to imagine that we actually have, within the parameters of our relationship with Jesus, that capacity to cause him sorrow in our foolishness and in our rebellion and so forth. And how much easier it is if we would just obey, even when it's not against our natural affection, because it rolls out to our benefit in the long run, and he knows that.